Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. We'll have a look at the front pages first, and obviously a lot of the front pages dominated by poor Mike Gaine and the shocking, really, discoveries at his farm over the last day. So the Sunday Independent is leading with Gardaí find grim trail of evidence in slurry field. The Sun on Sunday, body parts found in search for Mike. The Mirror, body parts found in farm fields. And the Irish Mail on Sunday, body parts found after field sprayed with slurry. The other papers, the Sunday Times is leading with Lowry, senior ministers give us weekly briefings. Michael Lowry has revealed that his regional independent group has access to a rota of ministers who will give weekly briefings to its TDs in Leinster House. And I'd say there are a lot of people in the political world this morning thinking, is he incapable of keeping his head down? The Business Post is dealing with an interesting story. Silicon Island tech giants to be wooed with billions in subsidies. So basically, I suppose we did very well out of the last industrial revolution, the tech revolution, and now there's a kind of another industrial revolution within it, which is around AI and chips particularly. They're strategically important and they are hugely economically important, and they are saying in this story that Ireland is going to promote itself internationally as a hub of semiconductor excellence, and aim to create 35,000 jobs, attract up to 3 semiconductor fabrication facilities. Strategic sites will be offered, serviced for high-tech manufacturing at significantly subsidised rates by the IDA, and the government are hoping that the likes of TSMC, you don't know who TSMC are, probably, they manufacture chips on behalf of NVIDIA, which you will have heard of. So that's that. And the Sunday World has a really shocking picture on the cover of a woman from Knocknaheeny in Cork called Jackie Toomey. And she wants everyone to see what her husband of 40 years, Noel Toomey, did to her in an appalling attack involving boiling water and a hammer. This woman had endured decades of abuse from this man, and this happened last January, and she wants people to see. And the headline is, "My husband is a monster." Now, our panel this morning, Scott Lucas, is Professor of International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Oisin Coughlan is a public policy advisor. Alva Smith is an activist and campaigner. And Sinead McSweeney is former global head of public policy at Twitter and a psychology student. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brendan.
Just before we get to the papers, if you put on your headphones there for a minute, we'll go to Kenmare first, where the Garda investigation into the disappearance of farmer Mike Gaine continues. And RTE's Sean Mockin-Tihig is at the Gaine farm in Kenmare this morning. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Brendan.
Sean, what's happening there this morning?
Well, it's quite a surreal scene here this morning, Brendan. Like, if you can imagine, I'm just below Moll's Gap, that famous tourist spot here. You've got majestic, rugged, mountainous terrain, sweeping valleys. It's a beautiful summer's morning, the smell of blooming hawthorn in the air. And then below me here in the farmyard, there's an awful lot of activity. I'm looking at some heavy machinery has been brought in, a digger that's been in and out of the large slatted unit, which is used to house cattle, raising concrete slats and gates out of the shed. You have a team of Gardaí who are carefully picking and digging their way through a pile of earth, stone and rubble about 50 metres from the shed. And then you have forensics are suited in white suits, and they're inspecting the slurry tank spreaders. There are two or three slurry tank spreaders in the farmyard here. So an awful lot of Garda activity here this morning. Of course, yesterday we witnessed Gardaí searching across the fields quite close to the farmyard itself. The night before, farm workers had been spreading some slurry and discovered human tissue We believe in the slurry tank spreader. It led to a search of the area that had just been spread, and further pieces of tissue were found there. We had the state pathologist arrive yesterday, along with a forensic anthropologist. An awful lot of activity yesterday evening. I'm just here at the gate of the farm now, and you can see flowers, candles, a number of messages. I'm just walking over here to read one. "We will never forget you, Mike. Say hello to everyone for me, XXX." And another one reads, "Our hearts are broken. We will never forget you. You were one in a million. Love you forever, Mike." So very, yeah. Very poignant scenes, very tragic scenes. Yeah. But
Sean, it's been a desperate number of weeks for the community down there, and I imagine a really desperate last 24 hours for them. Worse again. How are people feeling down there? They must be reeling.
They are, and you know, it's been very distressing, obviously for the family, but also the wider community. You know, when you look at the farming community in particular, in an area like this, a very rural, isolated area, it's a very tight knit community, and you can sense that talking to people. You know, and the fact that there was so little information that Mike Gaines seemed to have disappeared into thin air, of information, you get a lot of speculation, a lot of rumours, you know, a lot of unfounded stories and theories emerging, and it spreads like wildfire across the community, and it can create an element of tension in the community. But what you do sense here is the collective will to find answers. You got the sense in recent weeks that maybe the Garda investigation was being frustrated, but this is obviously a significant breakthrough, and one would hope that, as tragic as it is and as traumatic as it is, that it may lead to some of those questions being answered.
So what happens next now in this investigation?
Well, at present, while the Gardaí have confirmed that that human tissue has been discovered, DNA tests must be carried out on that tissue to confirm that whether or not it is Mike Gaines, but the Gardaí are saying that it probably is. So the Gardaí are continuing with their forensic examination here this morning, extremely busy and active, as I say, around the farmyard area this morning. Now, in terms of advancing the investigation itself, a suspect hasn't been identified, although the Gardaí did say 2 weeks ago that they were speaking to a person of interest. So obviously, this is a significant breakthrough in the case, and one would expect maybe more information to emerge in the coming days.
Okay, Sean McEntee, got the Gain Farm in Kenmare. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And look, I think we can all agree that is just a dreadful story that got a lot more dreadful in the last day or two, and that we are thinking of the Gain family and the community down there today as well, and poor Mike Gain. But we will go on to other events in the world now. Alva Smith, there's a lot across the papers today about 10 years on from the marriage equality referendum. You picked, there's a piece in the Sunday Independent by Padraig Royce, and he says a lot. He says it so simply. Little things like, I didn't know anyone gay when I was growing up. David Norris was the only one he saw or knew.
Yes. Well, absolutely. And I mean, Padraig, who worked for a considerable amount of time in LGBT Ireland, which is a tremendous organisation which works on behalf of members of the community, knows, you know, he knows where things are at. But what is lovely about this piece is that he writes very, very personally, and he begins by saying, you know, that it changed how the world, that this referendum and the victory changed how the world saw Ireland, but that also, and in a way even more importantly, it changed how we thought about ourselves and how we saw ourselves.
And changed how the LGBT people felt about how Ireland felt about them. That, okay, 5,000 or 6,000 weddings since then.
6,000.
Hardly changes the world in one way. But that for everyone who didn't didn't get married, it changed the world for them as well when this happened.
Yes, and I think that that has been really, really important. There was that real sense of, in a way, it was kind of like coming home.
Was it?
Well, that was what I felt, and I got that sense from Porig's piece as well, that you felt that you were truly at home in Ireland. And I mean, for me, considering I had, you know, lived 70 years in the country, it had taken a long time.
In a form of internal exile, do you think?
For a lot of that, yeah. Yes. Or of having to be incredibly careful, both in terms of your personal safety and security, but also, you know, how people perceived you, how you were greeted, accepted, embraced, if you like, that so many of us as LGBTIQ people were not embraced by the country that was and is our home. And this referendum did something really important. It changed that relationship completely.
Did you stop feeling other when this happened?
Let's say certainly on the day, yes. And I can remember being in a car, actually, kind of a van with the megaphone going round. Somebody gave me a megaphone, very foolish, going round saying...
You always had a megaphone in one
it's
shape or form.
It's okay to be gay. We're all gay today. And that was something that for me was really, really important, to feel that, you know, as a lesbian in this country, that I was no longer any kind of person to be held at arm's length, that I could be proud of who I am, very simply. And that comes across in Porig's piece.
The other side of Porig's piece, but
exactly.
10 years on.
I think it's been good for, on the whole, for the majority of lesbian and gay people, but it really has not, that it is becoming very much more difficult. And belong to the youth organisation, in a very recent study with Trinity, found that anxiety levels, stress, sense of distress, worry and concern among young LGBTIQs is really very worrying indeed, that this sense of being under threat is very strong. And I personally know many, many, many lesbian and gay, particularly gay men, and most especially trans people, who really are very concerned and afraid. There has definitely been a backward slide. And you can see that on the street. You certainly see it in social media, which has become so toxic that pretty well all the LGBT organisations are off the main social media platforms now, because it's just so absolutely dreadful. And you also see it in policy. You know that policy has kind of stagnated, it's slowed down, so that there are a lot of areas that just haven't been attended to. And I'm thinking, you know, the business about banning conversion therapy has been on the list of needs for a long time, and nothing is happening around that. What I would call the normalisation of LGBT parents, married parents, lesbian and gay married parents, that has not been normalised. It has not been properly legislated for you. So you can have a situation where a child has only one legal parent, even though those parents have gone through the kind of marriage registration and ceremony and all the rest of it that everybody else goes through. So I mean, that's absolutely a disgrace. And above all, the situation of trans people is really appalling and despicable, that there is... You could say that there is virtually no trans healthcare provision in any reasonable way for trans people. They are a tiny, minuscule, tiny little minority group, and we still cannot or will not provide proper trans healthcare. That is a blot on our copybook, and we really have to address it.
And my last point: there are good people working, trying to unravel that and sort out that.
Well, you know, it's taking them 10 years to do so, which is frankly a bit much. We had trans legislation 10 years ago too, and there is no recognition whatsoever for intersex people. So we did make progress. We are very proud of that, but things are hardening. These are dangerous, volatile times. We have to work really hard. And when I say we, I don't just mean LGBTIQs. I mean, our whole society has to work very hard to hold on to the wonderful gains that we made over those years.
Oisin, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I thought Power Crisis article was really well written for a start, and also then really, really moving. Yeah. Lee Ratker also has an article in the Sunday Times, which has a couple of interesting observations. He just on the issue of young people, he says that he was talking to professional sports person who said their teammates who are late 20s are all fantastic. That person is gay, no problem at all. But he's finding he's getting more abuse from 18 to 24 year olds. And that's countercultural, to put it mildly, to what we expect that younger generations will be more and more progressive, and seems to indicate just the general pushback or backlash there's been. And then I would think the toxifying effect of social media is at play there for sure. But he also makes the point about trans, again, that we're talking about a tiny minority, and that possibly some of it is to do with, you know, gay and lesbian people had to put themselves out there and tell their stories and go door to door to get marriage equality. But obviously when trans people are being so marginalised and there's so few of them, people haven't met trans people.
Yes, well, he says that they don't have to do that
in order to get their rights. But certainly there's been some weaponization of a tiny minority in order to try to hold back the progressive social movement we've had.
Sinead McSweeney.
Yeah, I think it was Leo who kind of went through the periods of kind of 5 years after Maref probably would still have had a decent majority, but like 5 years on from that again, we've seen an increase, I suppose, coarseness in public discussion, increased evidence and, you know, kind of unashamed expression of homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic sentiments and thoughts. And so, you know, that it resonated with me, that point around, you know, that dealing with 18 to 24 age group was, I think he said, was like going back to high school. I think that's a piece of work we have to do.
Yeah. And with your background from Twitter and everything else, it is interesting that, so the millennials or whatever, was that peak tolerance? And we thought that the next ones to come on, Z, I guess, at this stage, would be more so. But is it part of that social media manosphere, all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, so I mean, social media is the channel through which it's being executed, but it's not the actual driver, which is those who are.
But it amplifies very quickly what might have been before. Very fringe voices that mightn't have got, to use Alva's word, the megaphone.
Yeah, but I mean, these are like the likes of Peterson and Tate and others. These are people who have, you know, harnessed that amplifying potential of social media to effectively actually make money. I mean, the Tate operation is essentially a money-making operation. I read a interesting book recently, Clownland or Clown World, on just how that whole kind of organization is founded, and it's tapping into.
That's because of that. The social media companies reward engagement, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. What's happening? Well, one of the best ways to get engagement can be by being shocking and provocative and everything.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, Twitter banned Andrew Tate, but Musk put him back on. So, again, we can't lay the blame entirely at...
But are the algorithms at fault here?
The algorithms are driven by what people are interested in. So, you know, algorithms learn from people's activity, and human beings are drawn to, are drawn to ideologies that reinforce their own personal feelings. But yes, social media does.
I think there's a sense that the algorithms feed the worst of us, don't they? Because, like, if you're out in a society, and it goes back to, like, okay, you shouldn't have to meet trans people, but if you're out in the world with a diversity of people, you know, your better nature probably gets fed a bit. Whereas you go into those algorithms and it's feeding everyone.
And it brings you down
nature.
The rabbit hole, and it feeds the addictive dopamine hits of more and more short.
Scott.
Just fascinating. And thanks for the work, Alva, that you've been doing for so long for this. But a couple thoughts, Brendan. First of all, specifically on social media, and then if I make a wider point that I find tragically ironic. You know, the thing about social media is that the people there who are overlooking the algorithms, the people who are designing the companies, the people who have come after Sinead, are rewarding certain type of behavior. And I think in particular cases X with Elon Musk, who because of his own personal issues with his transgender child, Vivian Wilson, thinks that blames the system for
the
turning
woke
her trans.
Mind virus is what he blames for his daughter.
Exactly. And then when you amplify voices like J.K. Rowling, who already has a high profile, who also then comes in and piles on this, and you have entire national networks in the UK, for example, not just the US that amplify, then you get the cycle. And why I said tragically ironic, I think with respect, and I'd be interested in Alva's thoughts on this, that Ireland's LGBT community sort of drew from some of the energy that was in the United States in the past, the Stonewall movement, for example, the response to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, you know, the very idea of pride. And now, in a way, I hope the U.S. could draw back from what's happening in Ireland in a positive way, because what you're seeing is this is no longer fringe in the United States. Donald Trump and his inner circle are trying to disappear trans people, trying to deny them any rights whatsoever. And I think Billy Bragg, who I just think is a great musician but also activist, he compared it to the U.K. in the 1980s when we had to deal with Thatcher trying to erase the LGBT of the lesbian and gay community with the Section 28 legislation. And he said the lesbians and gays of the 1980s, the way that they were tarnished and stigmatized, those are the trans people of 2025.
Alva.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that, as I think Sinead put it, the weaponization of trans people here as in this whole process is absolutely extraordinary and appalling and deeply concerning, because trans people are themselves extremely vulnerable to violence, to sexual violence and so on. Yet they are repeatedly, relentlessly, poundingly represented as being a threat to humanity. And I mean,
I think as well, though, and we will just say to reflect this, that there are many people as well who would say that we do need to be very careful around how we treat teenagers who are identifying as trans, and that there should be proper structures in place there to give them the psychological and other support they need on their journey.
Of course, and yeah. all children need support. All children need, in this country, need far better SPHE programmes around sexuality and many other matters, no doubt, which they're not actually getting at the present time. I do think that we have to think very carefully. I certainly know in the LGBTIQ community that we're very, very aware that trans people are being made the target. They are being set up as this target of hatred, which is being whipped up by extreme right-wing forces who are absolutely hostile to equality, they are hostile to people's freedom, who want to create and stir division. And, I mean, I would somewhat disagree with Sinead. I think this process is being not discouraged, shall we say, by social media corporations who do have a responsibility, as do our governments.
And look, I do want to say as well, because there isn't someone here representing the other side of the discussion, if you will, that I think there are many well-meaning people of integrity who have many questions around it as well, who are not all evil people. There are people who disagree with a lot of what we've been saying, what's been said here today, but that's okay too. Sinead, just before we go to a break, there's a piece in the Sunday Times today, Bravery and Courage of Fallen Gardaí Honoured at Dublin event. I think you have a long experience with policing on both sides of the border here, and you were at the annual Garda Memorial Day to honour 19 members of An Garda Síochána killed in the line of duty yesterday at Dublin Castle, and I presume it was all the more emotional coming the day after the funeral of Garda Kevin Flatley. And I presume these are very hard times for the force, for all Gardaí.
Yeah, they're very hard days. Yesterday was particularly poignant. Garda Flatley's parents were there. It's always a beautiful ceremony. It's in the, there's a walled garden in the back of the of Dublin Castle, which is the Garda Memorial Garden, where the names of all of the guards who lost their lives in the line of duty are inscribed, and it's beautifully kept. And a wonderful setting, particularly yesterday. I suppose the sun was shining, but that didn't take from the kind of emotional nature of it. In 2010, when the garden opened, there were 83 names on the roll. Now, as of this week, there are 90. And the death of a colleague, it has ramifications way beyond the, you know, their own unit. It's very much felt by the entire Garda family, and obviously also we're thinking yesterday of his wife and two very young children who have to go through everything that comes with the death of a parent.
And you had to do it in public in the last few days with great grace, I think. Okay, we'll take a break. Scott Lucas, Oisin Coughlin, Alva Smith and Sinead McSweeney staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel are still with us. Scott Lucas, Oisin Coughlin, Alva Smith and Sinead McSweeney. Scott, just before we get into a discussion about the horrors of Gaza, and there's some very powerful pieces across the papers today, will you just give us a quick update on what has happened overnight? Well, yesterday evening, this map that has come out of an Israeli plan for Gaza now.
So as Israel has stepped up military operations, killing about 500 Gazans, almost all of them civilians, in the past 4 days, this document has now leaked, which is for their long-term occupation of Gaza, in effect adding to the occupation of the West Bank. There will be four military zones of control. There are three that already exist, one on the border between Gaza and Israel, one on the border between Gaza and Egypt, and one across the middle of the country. A fourth one will be added across the middle. So you've got four zones of control, and then you've got three tightly controlled centers of Gazan population in between them. Movement of Palestinians will be restricted. Their ability to gather in public will be restricted. Of course, almost all Gazan hospitals have been bombed and continue to be bombed. But other public spaces will be at risk of being attacked, of being hit. This has been coming for weeks. So to give you the broad context for this, Israel did agree to the phase one ceasefire, you might remember, in January and February. But there was no way the Netanyahu government was going to agree to phase two, which would be a longer ceasefire with Hamas. So at that point, either the Netanyahu government goes into an indefinite war, indefinite mass killing, or at some point, they say, we don't want to have to do the mass killing. We're going to control the population. And controlling the population means controlling them with security forces and controlling the humanitarian aid, because no longer does the humanitarian aid come through the UN or through independent NGOs.
So the long-term proposal here is some kind of a large prison camp, essentially, with a heavy military occupation all over it.
It's the West Bank amplified. It's already what the West Bank has, but it goes further. But I'd add one other thing that we don't know about with this map. And so we don't know about the question of whether there'll be forced displacement. There are certain Israeli ministers who favor forced displacement, notably the internal security minister the finance minister, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. They have actually advocated up to half of Gazans being removed, which is about 1 million people of the population. And there was a proposal floated this week, again, another document which leaked, which is that Libya would be given financial incentives to take in those 1 million Gazans.
Okay. So look, that's the broad picture. Sinead, to the picture that we've been watching for months now, but I think this week has, I mean, taken the biscuit really, like, is putting it mildly, what we're seeing. There's a very strong piece by Carol Balfe in the Sunday Independent, World Watches On as Dystopia Becomes the Living Reality in Gaza, which is a very simple point that not a bottle of water has got in there.
The 2nd of March.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, one has a sense of running out of words to describe how horrendous this reality actually is. Carl uses the word dystopia. The UN Secretary General during the week described it as a killing field, talked about an endless death loop. A very strong speech from President Higgins yesterday at the famine commemoration, where he, you know, talked about, you know, the aid being used as an instrument of war, or the and forced starvation. Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have also been very strong this week, talking about war crimes. But you kind of find yourself wondering, well, what more do people have to say? I mean, there's talk of women giving birth by C-section with no anaesthesia, no pain relief, and malnourished children. I mean, these are images that you just wonder how anybody can justify what the president called forced starvation of a nation of people and children, and all of the effects that it has. Even, you know, there was a doctor talked to during the week about the fact that you have children who have existing catastrophic injuries from bombings who are now also malnourished, and that's compounding any ability they had to recover.
To heal. Oisin, is it starting to feel like one of those generation defining atrocities now?
I mean, I think so. Like it's someone says in the coverage today, it is unimaginable. Like when you're not there, it's sort of unbearable, even though you're not there. But it's also almost, it's unimaginable. Although the stories today do a good job of helping us. There's Carol's piece where they talk about, you know, boiling leaves and milling dried pasta to try to create the pretense of a soup to give their children. And 130 babies are being born every day in Gaza, even though they haven't got the medical equipment to do it if there's complications, and there's no food for them when they're born. I mean, if there could be any more epitome of innocence, like, and yet they're being subjected to this. But in fact, there's a story, you mentioned the C-section. It's actually a woman called Shaima Fatou, who the Sunday Times have been following. Yeah. She gave birth to her baby by C-section without anaesthetic 4 months ago and is now struggling to keep the baby alive. But she talks about having to bring the baby to a doctor, to hospital, for some more routine thing. And she being shocked, like in the midst of living through this herself, shocked at the conditions in the hospital and what people are facing. And yes, it is good to hear Michael D. Higgins and the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach speaking as they have over the last week. But the question arises, what are we going to do about it? And I was struck by Liam Herrick, the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission Chief Commissioner, during the week, saying we have a responsibility to make sure that our airspace and our territory aren't being used to ship arms to Israel that could be used in these war crimes, as we have described them. There's no transparency. The UN Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Rights has said this too. There's no transparency about what's going through Shannon or over our airspace. And if we're serious about this, we are a small country, we can't do very much, but we are supposedly in control of our own airspace, and we have to step up on that score.
Alva, you wanted to, Sinead mentioned it there, but you did want to mention the president's speech.
Yes, I think it was a very, I thought it was a very powerful speech. And I also, you know, want to note that Michael D. Higgins as president is, you know, he is very courageous in actually naming what is happening, and particularly in relation to when these are profound moral issues. He's not afraid to speak out. In this particular case, for example, he says that, you know, while the UN Security Council is blocking and does block absolutely everything, that the United Nations does have the capability as a General Assembly of actually issuing statements, but also making demands, and of seeking to exercise some degree of power to bring to an end this appalling situation where people are being both bombed to death and now slowly starved to death. And I really admire him very much for actually going out on a limb from time to time and actually doing this, because, I mean, at the present time, this is beyond comprehension that the vast majority of world leaders are simply standing idly by, which makes, I think, all of our countries complicit in this absolutely horrendous, outrageous, extraordinary catastrophe, where an entire people are being annihilated and obliterated, not both slowly by starvation and also bombed out of bombed out of their lives, their livelihoods, their families, absolutely everything. And I think that while it was very admirable that Ireland stood with six other European countries the other day to demand an instant end to, you know, an instant ceasefire, an instant end to the war, that that's not enough. We have, I think, as Oisin says, certainly, and as Liam Herrick said the other day, to stop the passage of arms and other things through Shannon, but also...
And let us reflect that our government has been much more outspoken on this.
What it has not done,
most
Brendan,
other countries.
It has the occupied. It has not passed the occupied territories bill, and we are we are in our central bank processing Israeli war bonds. I mean, this is incomprehensible to me.
Sinead,
I was on
is there
a
political
yesterday
reality
with thousands of people. Thousands. Ireland feels very strongly about this, and we do not like the lack of our government has said the right words, and that is something. It is more than most leaders have done.
Sinead, is there a political reality about the Occupied Territories Bill that now is not the time, given what is going on between us and America and trade and everything else, to draw attention to ourselves with something like this?
I actually think it's a legal reality as opposed to a political reality. I've worked in the Attorney General's office, I've worked in the Department of Justice. I know what it is, the complications that come with passing a piece of legislation or drafting a piece of legislation, amending, as it would be in this case, what Senator Black has put forward. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's a kind of a political game playing.
Okay, you think that this is progressing as in the same way that any other piece of legislation would have to.
There's no doubt they've slowed it down. They're slow walking it since the election. I mean, the government was very much in favour of it before the election, although they didn't give time to passing it. And with Trump and the tariffs, there's no doubt that they're slow walking.
Okay, well, look, the two of you will have to agree to differ on that. Scott, just before we finish up on this, Scott, can we go back to the macro picture and, you know, everyone saying, like, the world ignoring this or doing nothing about it. Like, is there any sign of an end to this? I mean, is it hopeful in a way that Trump is kind of his support of Netanyahu is potentially diminishing?
No, because the reason why Trump's support of Netanyahu is diminishing is because he's being flattered by the Gulf states. And the fact is that the Trump administration has checked out on Israel-Gaza. Since they knew they wouldn't get a phase two ceasefire, they don't get a win out of it. And so you've got the super envoy, the real estate developer Steve Witkoff running around everywhere, who just isn't up to the job. But I'll come back to what I will suggest just a second. I do think that now that we've gotten past St. Patrick's Day, and since Trump is wildly hitting out anybody, coming back and talking about the Occupied Territories Bill needs to be raised with recognition of the fact that it's not so simple as just adopting it. But one broader point, I would like to see Ireland and other states talk about joining an attempt by sea to bring in humanitarian aid, a flotilla of aid. Now, I don't think they'll do it because they'll cite security reasons. But the one effort to bring aid by sea, which was through a Turkish charity, the Israelis immediately tried to bomb it.
But Biden did attempt to build a jetty at one point and do all that.
But the jetty doesn't work because the jetty didn't work because the Israelis are still simply controlling it. The symbolism of bringing in an international flotilla to try to bring aid in would raise the ante with how far the Israelis are going to go to maintain this choke.
Okay, so you think we put it up to them in some way?
We have a long history of humanitarian relief. We should put our...
Scott, so you mentioned there Trump's extraordinary tour of the Middle East during the week. You've picked a piece in the Sunday Times by Katie Bowles, Big Deals, a Qatari Jet, and Eyes on the Nobel Prize, what Trump is really up to in the Middle East. Just before we get into the broader question, there was one thing that seemed, if you were just looking at it as a child might this week, you might have thought, and he even mentioned Europe in derogatory terms while he was out there. Is the world pivoting towards the Middle East? You know, we're all concerned about China being the new superpower and all this, but here you have these people who in the desert have built these extraordinarily wealthy, advanced civilizations that we can tend to dismiss a bit here as, oh, Dubai, a shady place. We dismiss them as well because of their human rights issues. But is the Gulf becoming a major power player in the world? And is that what we saw this week?
That's been the case since the 1970s.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
that people haven't woken up to it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And I think what has made 2025 different is the United Gulf States, because of the oil wealth, because of some very ambitious regimes, especially the Saudi regime under Mohammed bin Salman, trying to stake their position in the region and beyond. It's that, the again, the Trump administration is effectively checking out as an effective influence in the Middle East.
But did we see, you know, we talk about sports washing by those countries. Did we see a form of Trump washing this week? Like, it felt as if they're suddenly on the international stage in a completely different way to the way they've ever been before.
Well, the Saudis, the UAE and Qatar, in the first year of Trump 1.1, had intelligence reports, which is, you want to get something out of the United States, you flatter Trump because he's a narcissist. Point blank. And they did it back then, 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. The difference now is, in 2025, we've got Gaza going on. We've got the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine. We've got the question of where China's going. The Gulf states are in the middle of all of this. And the idea is, we're not going to follow Washington on this. We're certainly not following Trump. We're going to leverage Trump to get as much as we can out of him. They are giving big payoffs to Trump personally, which I can talk about if you want to. The golf courses, the hotels, the investment in Jerry Kushner's fund.
The plane.
But more broadly,
so property development really trumps, if you will, politics, anything else. This was a meeting of property developers.
Yeah, but not for the Gulf states. What the Gulf states are looking at is, we use the property development, and then we do what Trump isn't doing is, which is, we think in terms of our political strategy here. What do we want out of the states? We want to build up our military. Yes. So we'll buy the war planes, we'll buy the Boeing planes, and let Trump present that as a win. What do we want from Trump? We want him to recognize that we have autonomy in this area in terms of our own issues, including repression of our populations if need be, and we will intervene in our own time of Gaza. Trump gives that to them. What do we want? We want to call the shots on Iran and our relations with Iran and not be led by Trump's unpredictability. They got all of that and more.
Okay. Oisin, you were looking at
that piece. Yeah, well, I mean, I think, first of all, it shouldn't be surprising to us that Donald Trump is attracted by glitz and gold and dictators and dollars. And that's very much what was happening this week. He was in a kind of a playground of his imagination, what he'd like to do to New York or to Gaza, God help us. But I think Scott's right that that weirdly, for this guy who sells himself as the art of the deal, he often does deals that are very bad. They are getting far more out of this than he is in terms of their position. And don't forget, their wealth has been built on the exploitation of fossil fuels, which when they started, we didn't know the damage they were doing, but they are the epitome of that, which of course has no concern of Donald Trump either. But it's interesting, we are seeing in the international politics, not just on the more geopolitical sense, but on the climate sense, we're now seeing the US, Russia and Saudi Arabia lining up together in favour of more and more fossil fuels, and China joining India, the EU, Australia, Japan, and saying, we need to keep with the transition. And that is head spinning in terms of global
that
alliances.
If we're looking for the Chinese to be the ones leading.
Yes, they're the ones who are sort of coming off the fence, but they are at the moment joining in climate policy discussions. They're joining Europe and the rest.
Sinead, you looked at Shane Ross in the Sunday Independent, did you, who's kind of a localist take on this? We must indulge Trump if it means lives will be saved.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a case of that. A couple of people have put across that, as well as deal chasing, Trump is also Nobel Peace Prize chasing. Shane Ross's thesis,
he talks about this a lot. He does feel quite
feels hard done by it.
It's a delusion to list of deals.
Yeah, I think, Shane Ross's kind of, I suppose, basic thesis is that we should therefore just all kind of hold our noses and put up with his worst excesses if peace is at the end of it. I'm not sure that Trump's trip to the Middle East had anything to do with peace. He's probably almost get the sense that he's decided that there's no deal to be made there. So he's kind of focusing back.
I don't want to be seen
on,
in the region of that.
He's kind of going to focus his hopes of a peace prize on Ukraine, Russia. It's a difficult one. You know, you could say yes if peace is at the end of it, and you know there's some relief for the suffering of the people of Gaza, and Trump could achieve peace. Yeah, maybe we should turn our face away, but there is that sense of what price peace in terms of principles of
Did you see that extraordinary speech he made, which actually got a lot of praise from some weird quarters, where he talked about you people have been told long enough how to live your lives and what you should believe and how to run your societies by the neocons going back years and by America and everything else. I'm here to say we don't judge you, like, and you do what you want. And it was really a moment of, look, you know, whatever way you choose to treat your people, minorities, LGBT, everything else, I'm not going to lecture you on that. Let's just do business.
I really don't care. I don't really care what happens to people, is what he's in effect saying. I couldn't care less. What I'm really interested in is the $1 trillion that I may get into the US to make it great again by selling these people arms. And they're also very interested, as far as I understand it, in AI. You know, they're into America, so to speak, North America, because they want AI, they want more arms. And this is not for the good of people. Absolutely not. This is not to make the world a more humane place. This is not to stop wars. This is not to end the appalling damage to the environment and climate. Not for any of these reasons. This is about a kind of extreme form of capitalism, which we are now living in. And that is fed and intensified by someone like Trump. The other dimension to it that you know, the bit about the plane. First of all, everybody knows that there's no such thing as a free plane. So if it's, you know, costing $400 million or whatever it is, that there is, of course, a price to be paid. And again, Trump simply doesn't care. There is a regulation. There is actually a law in the US which says that presidents may not accept gifts over and above, I think it's something like $450 or $480, unless they actually pay for them. He doesn't have $400 to pay for a plane.
I saw a very plausible Qatari on last night explaining patiently that, no, this is our Ministry of Defence is dealing with their Ministry of Defence. Right, we have lawyers working on both sides.
Scott's
it's all above board. Yeah. Scott, quickly before we take a break, I know you picked a couple of pieces on Zelensky, but could you just give us a quick picture of where we at in terms of, are we inching closer to some kind of a deal here or
no,
not?
Because the Kremlin doesn't want a deal. The Kremlin wants Ukraine's capitulation.
And is Trump now more on Zelensky's side, as
he's
we're led to believe?
Yeah. He's all over the map. So let's lay it out. First of all, in terms of the Russians, they said two things in the negotiations they leaked to the press, which are keen. One is, we want control of four of your regions plus Crimea. If you don't give it to us in these talks, next time we're coming back, we're asking for six. Secondly, we fought Sweden for 21 years back in the 17th century. We'll fight you forever. That's where
Is he willing to have a long war here? Is Russia? Are the Russian people willing to do this?
Russian people is a different question. But for Putin, this is his legacy. His legacy was to make Ukraine part of greater Russia so he doesn't stop. So the broad picture is we're talking about what happens now in the longer run. Yeah. And that is Ukraine and Europe are positioning themselves in terms of saying we're not caving into Russia. That's why they keep saying the 30-day ceasefire. The Kremlin rejects it. And then Ukraine and Europe say, well, if the Kremlin won't accept a ceasefire, we've got to maintain the resistance. And Europe slowly, and perhaps not enough, but is stepping up to the mark in working with Ukraine. And they're trying to reach out to some of the adults still in the room in the Trump administration, like the envoy to Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, to work with them. Trump is unpredictable all over the map. But those people in the Trump administration in recent weeks, almost unnoticed, have actually released the hold on military deliveries to Ukraine, including parts from F-16 fighter jets and ammunition.
And they also seem to have indicated in some way that they were willing to support more sanctions when the Europeans went
Lindsey Graham was in the Middle East this week too, so he's a senator, and he has ready to go a bill of really quite strong sanctions. Trump is so unpredictable, and he's not going to stand up to Putin or Netanyahu, it seems, who want ongoing wars, but he might let Graham's bill go through to ramp up the pressure on Putin.
Okay, all right, we'll take a break. Scott Lucas, Oisin Coughlin, Alva Smith and Sinead McSweeney are staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Scott Lucas, Oisín Coughlan, Alva Smith and Sinead McSweeney are still with us. I'm going to let the two academics go at it now, right? Because, you know, this plan of we're going to lure all the American academics over here. So we'll start with the American academic who was lured over here. Scott, there are several pieces across the paper. You were looking at Owen O'Malley. Is it true that if you're in a university, instead of being able to book a cheap flight on Ryanair if you're going to a conference, you have to go through this portals to travel agents and end up paying much, much more because of red tape and everything else?
I think Owen O'Malley may have issues with his own university, which I'll leave unnamed, but it's not true in my case. And O'Malley also says some other things that are very disparaging of gender studies, for example, and diversity.
Okay.
I want to leave that piece aside.
How were you lured here? Like, are we an attractive place for an American academic of good standing to come?
I'm not sure people would say I'm of good standing. But what I say is, of course, I was lured here after having spent a lot of time in the UK. But
then that's different.
But the reason there's still some reasons though that do resonate. For example, I was lured here in part because of what had happened with Brexit, and Ireland offered an alternative, which is inside the EU, which was not going to be economically on a downward spiral like the UK was going to do, which was more socially progressive than the UK was going to be, and I think where the US is going with economic issues, with social issues, Ireland has these advantages, which I think are overlooked.
Okay, so if academics who suffer from the woke mind virus, which many of them do, they might find it's a friendlier country for that kind of thing. Yeah.
Now that's
I'm being tongue in cheek. Yeah.
But you know, if you know, I've got my own woke mind virus going on, but I think it's great here. I think what the Business Post pieces raise, and there are a couple of them in the Business Post, is look, if you want to attract the American academics, you need to pay attention to your Irish academics and your resources. You need to build up your universities by putting more into them. You need to look more at some bureaucratic issues that have hampered Irish universities in the past. And of course, the two go hand in hand. The more you start to develop Irish education, higher education sector, those other advantages I've talked about become more apparent, not only to American academics, but to those from other countries who can come here. So Ireland has an opportunity with its higher education sector, but as we've talked about with housing, with transport, et cetera, the government has got to take advantage here.
Alva, would you be one of the, you're kind of semi-academic emeritus, we could say, at this stage.
Yes.
Would you share the views of, there's been lots of academics out over the last week freaking out, going, you know, treat your own a bit better first, and PhD students who are teaching and all that kind of thing have a very tough time.
I think there is a very real sense in which the minister, James Lawless, seems to have kind of lost the run of himself a little bit on this, because, you know, first of all, Ireland, whatever you think about world rankings for the universities, I mean, Ireland simply does not feature.
And Ian Guider reflects that in the Business Post today. We're not world beaters.
It's 139 Trinity is at, and it's been dropping. And in fact, all of the other universities are over the, you know, 200, 201, 34, et cetera, et cetera. Number one. Number two, we have not made any strategic investment in research infrastructure in this country for I don't know how long. Scott probably would know better than me, but there has not been the kind of investment that we need to make for our own sakes, never mind about luring and attracting academics from the States. And thirdly, we actually pay so many of our academics at lamentably low rates. In fact, you know, for PhDs and postdoc academics, they're leaving their careers, they're leaving the academia in scads because they're paid so very, very little.
That we pay academics here much quite highly compared to international.
Not if you're a postdoc.
So it's at the early stages of their career.
And so increasingly, can I just say that increasingly, academic staff are are employed on short-term contracts, which are extremely precarious, which have no tenure, and which certainly do not indicate that there is a career path. So unless you have a career path as an academic, you really cannot stay in the business.
Okay.
And the final point you'd make is that even if American academics were foolish enough, I will say, to come here in the expectation of good research funding, where are they going to live?
Oh, yeah, OK. Sinead McSweeney, will we take a minute or two at the end to reflect on the great Paul Durkin, who has died aged 80?
Yeah, really sad news yesterday. And I think it probably came a little bit too late for today's papers. And I'm hoping that tomorrow's papers will make up for it, because I think he would deserve every word written about him. When I saw the news, I immediately took down my copy of the Berlin Wall Cafe from the shelf and was transplanted back to 1980s Ireland, where we were doing a particular kind of poetry in school. And yes, then we're just seeking out this wonderfully provocative, kind of vaguely subversive poetry. And I was out with a group of friends from my UCC days last night and actually realised I wasn't the only one who had that same
thought. He was kind of a rock star.
He was you couldn't get enough of him. And now he's on the Leaving Cert syllabus. It would probably be...
So look, maybe the what is it, the arm of progress does bend towards in the right direction ultimately if you go from being him to being on the Leaving Cert course. Okay, listen, that was a terrific hour. Thank you very much, Scott Lucas, Oisín Coughlan, Alva Smith and Sinead McSweeney. And it's just 12 noon now, and we'll go to Aidan Fitzsimons in the newsroom.